Tonight on Arena, Cruella Drunk Bus, I Used to Be Normal, and a new documentary on Alex Ferguson are the movies up for review. And 17 years later, the cast of Friends are back together. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Thursday night, as always, is film night, review night here on Arena. On the bill this evening, Cruella, the 101 Dalmatians prequel, Drunk Bus, an odd couple slacker comedy. Two documentaries, I Used to Be Normal, about the girl fans of boy bands, and Alex Ferguson, Never Give In, a portrait of the legendary football manager who can't have been too thrilled last night with Man United's performance in the Europa League final against Villarreal. Tara Brady and Daryl Jones have been watching the four films for us, and where else could we start but with Cruella, the origin story of the dastardly dog stealer herself, starring Emma Stone as said Cruella and Emma Thompson as the Baroness. Tara, I suppose, why are we so obsessed with origin stories? There seems to be a lot of them about at the moment.
Well, I suppose it's a good way of expanding your IP, and there's only so many sequels you can go. So this is this is another direction. There's also, I suppose, certainly after Wicked, there's this definite desire to revisit villains and villainesses, and it worked very well for Disney with Maleficent a few years ago. The downside of that is that very often what they're doing is they're taking characters that are, you know, that are great villains, and that's what's fun about them, and they're taking all their wickedness away because they're having to humanize them and give them proper story arcs and put them on a journey and all those things that modern screenplays are supposed to do, and in doing so they kind of ruin the character. And I think that's very much the case here, where they're not really too sure what to do with the character. You know, in certain directions they've humanized her too far. In other directions they've taken her to places where the Cruella then you meet in 101 Dalmatians doesn't really make any sense.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a problem, and that extends then to the film's tone, which can't really decide. It's not a comedy, and it's not a drama, and it's certainly not a kid's film.
Yeah, and it's very long. Not all of those three things. Tara drawing comparisons there with Maleficent as the kind of prequel to Wicked, if you like. Did you see that comparison there as well?
Oh, very, very much so. I very much agree with everything that Tara's just said, in fact. And I think that this really is a problem for the film. There's a kind of philosophical problem here, which is the need to understand and to psychoanalyze and to explain and to sympathize and to empathize and to find them, for goodness sake, to use that awful word, relatable. I think this is what we're trying to do with Cruella herself here. Cruella is born Estella. And her mother names her Cruella, or names the kind of dark and rebellious side of her personality, Cruella. The problem with this film is that it's far too much Estella and far too little Cruella. Yeah. As you say, it's a very long film, but there should be a kind of ruthless, heartless, clever, mean-spirited, nasty short film trying to get out, but it never quite
manages
Disney won't
that.
Let it out.
Right, well, let's have a listen to a clip. It takes us a long time to get to the Emma Stone get to Emma Stone, because we're getting the child origins as well. We get the origins of Cruella from Estella for the first maybe half hour of the film, I think. But at this point, Emma Stone is firmly fixed in the position of Cruella, and she's working in the world of fashion, or at least wants to work in the world of fashion. And Emma Thompson is the Baroness for whom she wants to work. Here they are meeting each other.
Who are you? You look vaguely familiar.
I look stunning. I don't know about familiar, darling.
Your hair, is it real?
Like my ball. I like to make an impact.
Right. What was your name?
Cruella.
Oh. That's quite fabulous. And you designed this?
You did, actually. 1965 collection.
Oh, no wonder I love it. It's mine.
Emma Stone and Emma Thompson there as Cruella and the Baroness in the prequel Cruella film that we were speaking about this evening. Tara, even that clip, which is 36 seconds long, it takes them an awful lot, a long time to say very little. Get on with it. No big pauses, thank you.
It really, really does. I mean, this reminded me of a certain kind of Netflix film that Netflix kind of comes under fire for. They're what I call all the money in the world films, where they like throw money and they get in the best director, they get in, you know, the best sort of people that money can buy. And sometimes you end up with great films like Roma and Uncut Gems. And sometimes you end up with absolute stinkers like Hillbilly Elegy. But more often than not, you end up with these kind of flat films that just don't work. And I think this is one of those. I mean, the sound track alone, with like Nina Simone's Feeling Good and The Clash's Should I Stay or Should I Go, must have cost a fortune. Even the kind of small parts, never mind the fact you have two Oscar winners going toe to toe in the main parts, you also have like the smaller part, like really great people like Paul Walter Hauser, who was in Clint Eastwood's Richard Jewell, and you know, for no reason at all, people like Emily Beecham you get the star of West End's Everybody's Talking About Jamie, and they just put him there and they don't really know what to do with him. And that's kind of emblematic of everything else that's going on in the film. They really know what to do with it.
Yeah, we also have screenwriters from The Devil Wears Prada, which is a short, nice, nasty film in its own way. But this, they didn't do short, nice and nasty in this. 101 Dalmatians, 134 minutes. How many stars from you, Tara?
Two.
What are you saying, Daryl?
Well, it looks fantastic, and there are lots of incidental pleasures along the way. So maybe a generous three from me.
A generous three from you. That's Cruella, first of our four films up this, for review this evening. Let's go to Drunk Bus now. The title says it all. An odd couple comedy. This is set in Kent, Ohio. First time writers and directors John Carlucci and Brandon LaGang about the friendship that develops between a Samoan security guard and a college bus driver. And Tara saying that the last film was one of those lots of money thrown at it films. This was one where I would say scraping together the last few dollars in the bottom of a jar type of movie. It's made on a shoestring, I would guess.
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, I'm amazed. I don't think they could afford a soundtrack. And it's very, very much the better for it, I think. Yeah, so this is the kind of film that when you approach it, you think, I've seen this film dozens of times before. You know, it is a slacker comedy. It's a film with jokes about alcohol, about drugs, about sex. It's an odd couple movie, stuck in a rut. A night bus driver who does the same thing every night, you know, driving through this snowbound college town with the same people every night, meets gigantic Samoan security guard who brings him out of himself. So you think, I've seen this before. But that would be to underestimate the film. I think the people who made this film have put a lot of kind of care and love into it. And it's a film that cares about the people who are in it, I think.
Yeah, and the two, I suppose the odd couple at the centre of it, Tara, a character called Pineapple, played by Pineapple Tangaroa, a Samoan actor, I'm presuming, and Charlie Tahan, who's playing who's the bus driver, Michael, who goes this route every night. He can He said, look, those lights, they'll go off now. Oh, there's the woman on the side of the road. She's about to smell her dog's poo. She smells the dog's poo. He can predict everything. It's mind-numbing, his job.
I think that's where the film succeeds. It is a very familiar film. If it's very like 100 other films that you've seen that were big at Sundance or SWSW, one of the kind of big independent film festivals. But I think where it succeeds is it's a film that's drawn from real life. This was Brandon LaGang, who's one of the writers and directors. This was his life. He was driving the drunk bus. He was stuck in a rut, and he did he ended up on his old college campus, ferrying around all these drunken students. And and he did meet Pineapple, and they did become friends, and that's the real Pineapple. And that's a lot of those episodes are taken from his life. And while it is very, like, I suppose in parts an early Kevin Smith film, and it has the swearing and it has quite crass bits in it, and it has you know, it has bongs and all the things you expect a kind of juvenile slacker comedy to have. It's very, very big hearted. And you can tell that, you know, people care about it. And I really did like F.U. Bob, the elderly wheelchair user who was a bit like Father Ted's Jack, I think, like only capable of swearing. And, you know, we'd learn quite late on that he has this rich inner life. Yeah. So, yeah, it is small and it is familiar, but yeah, it's certainly heartfelt.
Well, let's listen to a clip. Pineapple, the aforementioned, played by Pineapple Tangaroa, dares Charlie to hands Michael on the bus. He's saying, look, it's just time you broke out of this rut. You need to change things.
What you need is a do-over, right? You see those 40s over there? Grab two bottles and let's dip.
No. I'm not stealing 40s with you.
You want a fucking do-over, it starts with those two bottles. Grab the two bottles and let's dip.
Dude, this guy's right there.
He's sleeping. He won't even miss it. Quit being a bitch. Grab those 40s and let's dip. Go.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Couldn't quite remember a soundtrack from it, but there is a bit of a soundtrack there as well. That's from Drunk Bus. Daryl, would you agree with Tara in terms of it's big-heartedness that makes this stand out from the crowd, even though it is, you know, it's a very familiar setup? There's an old girlfriend as well that the bus driver character just quite can't get over, and there are other love interests involved as well. What makes it stand out?
Yeah, I mean, as Tara said, it's big heartedness, but also, you know, it has a splendid, rather well developed, I think, cast of characters. You know, you meet the same people ride the bus night after night, and over the course of the film, we get to find things out about them. Bob, the cantankerous old git that Tara's mentioned already, who does indeed turn out to have this rich artistic life. But others as well. But it also, I think, has a real sense of place. You know, we're in Kent, Ohio, which is a college town. The only thing I know knew about it beforehand was that it's notorious as the site of the location of the killing of student protesters by the Ohio National Guard. Neil Young wrote a song about it. You know, it's a part of America that you don't normally get to see very often, and here you get to see it, you know, through the windows of a bus full of drunk people. But it really does have this sense of place. So I think it's a film made with love.
Made with love, and getting how many stars from you as a result, Daryl?
I think I've talked myself into giving it 4.
Did you have to talk yourself into giving it a large number of stars, or did they come popping out of your heart, Tara?
My heart's not that big. I'll go 3.5.
3.5 from Tara. Okay, Drunk Bus, the title of that second movie. Let's move on then to I Used to Be Normal. A Australian filmmaker involved here, Jessica Leskey, looking at the phenomenon of adolescent superfan in her documentary It Used to Be Normal, a boy band fangirl story. Four women from four different generations recall their love of the Beatles, take that, Backstreet Boys, One Direction, and that immediately puts them into their decades. Not that I want to put you into your decade, Tara, but was there one or other of these bands that made you go, I remember that?
No, I was always too elitist to be into boy bands. it's very interesting because it's not Jessica Leskey herself became a directioner, as in a One Direction fanatic at the grand old age of 31, as she puts it, and that's what got her interested in this phenomenon. But this is a lovely, very, again, heartfelt, but a really fun and heartfelt documentary. And I at some point they I know that she had done an awful lot of research like into things like Listomania, which was the huge phenomenon around Franz Liszt, the Hungarian composer, as he used to play around Europe, and the you know, women would come out and they'd faint and they'd scream and they'd do all that sort of thing. So it's not a new phenomenon, yeah. But in the end, she left out that kind of research and just let the women tell their own stories. And I think that's one of the film's great strengths. It keeps it really simple, but it actually makes it very, yeah. very direct and very, very moving in places. So you have Elif, who's this young Turkish American, young journalist who's so obsessed with the Backstreet Boys that her and 2,000 other fans end up going on a cruise with them, which is apparently a regular thing. It's one of the most bizarre things you've ever seen in your life. All these 30-something women going on a cruise, and Backstreet Boys will come out on deck, and there'll be photo opportunities, or they'll perform for them in the evening, and this goes on over a couple of weeks. You have a young Turkish American girl who's obsessed with One Direction at the start of the film, and that kind of brings her in conflict with her family, and then you have Dara, who's obsessed and who's now in her 30s, and she was obsessed with Take That, and then you have Susan, who's the oldest, who's the Beatle maniac. But each one of them finds, you know, there's something different for each of them about the boy bands. For Dara, for example, her obsession with Gary Barlow is a way into discovering her own sexuality. So there's lots of really interesting journeys that each of them has a very, very meaningful story arc, and it's not kind of grafted on or invented. It's right there. It's organic.
Let's have a listen to a clip from the film, some of the fans outside a One Direction concert.
Oh my God, that was the best concert I've actually ever been to.
We got Harry's attention a lot.
A lot. Once I went like this, I went like that, and then he went like this too.
He moved to the side, and I was like, oh.
There you go, clip from I Used to Be Normal, some of the fans outside a One Direction concert. And in the interest of equality, Daryl, I guess I should ask you, were there any bands at which, when you saw them coming up on screen watching this film, that you went, oh, I remember that? Or, oh, I used to love when I put my head to the side and then the band member put his or her head to the side and it was exactly the same as me?
Well, I mean, there are moments in this film where I found myself, you know, confronting and coming up against my own sort of masculinist rock sensibilities and preconceptions. You know, the Beatles, a boy band, I wasn't having that. But then I thought, hang on, no, wait a minute. You know, the Beatles are many things, and one of the things they are is indeed a boy band. Yeah. This is not music for me for the most part. You know, you begin to understand why the women in the film, why it means so much to them.
Yeah, because as Tara was touching on it there, you're saying this is not the music for me, but this isn't necessarily about the music. It is about the cultural phenomenon that is a boy band across those different generations. You know, Elif is in her teens, 16. The Sadie of the Blackstreet Boys woman is 25. Mm. Dara, the Take That fan, 33, and Susan, the Beatles fan, 64. So, you know, you're getting a kind of a social view, and it would seem that the words and the tunes might change very slightly, but basically the songs are more or less the same. And I'll stick with you on that one, Daryl. In other words, what is the social history we're getting here?
That's right. Well, you know, it strikes me, and we heard it in the clip you just played there. This is a film which has an awful lot of screaming in it, and Susan, the Beatles fan, makes this very powerful and compelling case. She says, you know, you have to trust that your body knows what it's doing, that your body knows what it wants, and she says it was so cathartic to scream like that. And you know, we discover across the film that each of the women involved has their own reasons to scream. And many of these reasons are interrelated. So Susan herself, back in the 60s, wanted to study medicine. But her father wouldn't allow her to do so. He thought it was a waste of time for a girl to study medicine.
Yeah.
And then a version of the same story is played out what, it must be two generations later, with young Elif, the yes. Turkish-American girl. She wants to go to college to study music, but her parents won't allow
don't
it.
Want that, yeah.
And so, you know, each of them is struggling and using the music as a way to sort of
all
think
right.
through and live through these kinds of conservatism that they're faced with.
And we do follow the journey of the four women across 4 years, and I think that's an important aspect. So it's not just a snapshot. Why did you do that? And then they're gone. We don't learn anything more about them. We do see growth and change in all of their lives. Stars from you on this one, Daryl?
Oh, four.
Four? In generous mood. Are you more generous on this one, Tara?
No, I'd definitely say four. No, I think it's lovely. It's never condescending. It's important yeah. to mention about the women either. It's very respectful.
Yeah, and it doesn't condescend to the music and being a fan of that music mm-hmm. either, which I think is important. Finally and briefly then, you've seen this one, Tara, Alex Ferguson, Never Give In, documentary made by the legendary manager's son. I'm not expecting mm-hmm. I'm not expecting huge objectivity here. Is it basic a hagiography?
It. I mean, you couldn't say it isn't a hagiography. It's certainly. If you're expecting stuff about the Rock of Gibraltar, or you're expecting anything about those kind of famous boot room bust ups with Roy Keane or anything like that, you're not going to get them. And nor do you get any great kind of tactical analysis. You get the kind of typically Ferguson gruff. You know, psychology is someone else's word. I call it management. and that sort of thing. I am not the target audience for this. I'm a Liverpool fan, but I find it very engaging for the duration. I think it's very interesting to like look back on that period, especially when you see the chance to Fergie out in 1989, and it reminds you of the time when like club managers were actually given a few seasons to fail, which I don't think there'd be any chance yeah. That they'd be given now. I think where it's really good is where it's Ferguson growing up and in the shipyards in yeah. Govan, and his apprenticeship as a toolmaker, and also his marriage to his Catholic wife Kathy, and how that gets in the way with Rangers, who was his boyhood club.
Let's listen to a clip which gives a sense of that background, and also gets into this idea of how he motivates his players.
I used to lie in bed thinking about themes where I could address the players that would make an impact in them, you know? I would talk about miners, shipyard workers, welders, toolmakers, you know, people who come from poor backgrounds. And I used to ask them, what did your grandfather do? What did your father do? But I have to get the feeling inside them that what their grandfathers worked for and their grandmothers is part of them, and they have to display that meaning and taking away all the trophies I've won and the great prayers I've had. I think it's a thing about life. It's a fact of life. Where we come from is important. You come out with an identity.
And that's Alex Ferguson in the documentary Alex Ferguson, Never Give In. Just one thing briefly, Tara, before you get your stars. You mentioned that there's no bust-ups in this with the David Beckham, the Roy Keane, all of those things. But do we get anything from Roy Keane? I know Ryan Giggs and Eric Cantona are there, but is Roy Keane present?
No, it's very much. I think that the even Eric Cantona's contribution is quite short, and there's more of Ryan Giggs. Far more focused, as I was saying, about the family. And I mean, I did not expect myself to sit there during the film and go, I thought there'd be more Manchester United, and I think there is, and I think that is a problem for it. And I understand why there's not so much of the Man United because it's such a success story. It's not necessarily an engaging narrative to yeah. just have, and then he won this, and then he won that, and then he won the other. Yeah. But it is a little bit of a lack, I think, in the film.
All right, put your Liverpool jersey to the one side now. Stars, stars out of five.
Oh, it's a very solid three.
A very solid three. Oh, yeah. I wonder if it was about Bill Shankly, would it be a very solid four or five? Anyway, I jest. That is your, I'm sure, objective opinion, Tara. And thank you for
indeed.
It. Tara Brady and Daryl Jones there, our reviewers this evening. Cruella is out on Disney. Alex Ferguson, Never Give In is on Amazon Prime. And I Used to Be Normal and Drunk Bus are both on general digital release. Tonight, 17 years after David Crane and Marta Kaufman's era-defining sitcom came to an end, Friends finally returns to our screens for a one-off reunion special. Ross, Rachel, Chandler, Joey, Phoebe and Monica are back in Central Park. More correctly, David Schwimmer, Jennifer Aniston, Matthew Perry, Matt LeBlanc and Lisa Kudrow and Courtney Cox are back on the set of the Central Perk, the New York coffee house, where it all began and where one of the most popular sitcoms of the 90s came to life. Ahead of this special, Chris Wasser is here to look at the success of the original series and to what we might be getting in this reunion of kinds. And we should be clear about this. This isn't a new episode or anything like that. It's a totally different animal, really, Chris.
No, it's not a new episode. And I think the greatest trick that HBO Max never played, they didn't have to, was somehow convincing audiences that this was going to be a scripted, you know, episode, sort of a catch-up with the actual characters 17 years later. But it's not. It's more of a celebration. I mean, they're calling it the one where they get back together, which, of course, is a reference to the famous titles. Every episode of Friends is the one with or the one where. But I would really call it the one where the actors from Friends revisit Friends, because that's what it is. You know, it's a beloved celebration. You have all six actors who remained friends long after the series came to an end, revisiting the sets in California and Burbank, where every episode from season 2 to season 10 was filmed. And it's an interesting visit for them, because the night that the final episode of Friends was recorded in front of a live audience in 2004, all of the sets were immediately dismantled so that, you know, other shows could be made there.
Yeah.
So to do this, to get this special up and running, each set, you're talking about the apartments, you're talking about every bedroom, the Central Perk coffee house, they had to be painstakingly reassembled. And you know this because when the actors actually walk into the set for the first time, they're astounded that they are just so alike to where they worked for the 10 years when they were involved in Friends.
Yeah, I'll come back to a little bit more of how the thing plays, this reunion plays out in itself. But I suppose let's go back to that the very first episode, the pilot episode. It set out its stall of what exactly we were going to get. It was so powerful, really, in some ways, when you think of what came afterwards.
It really was. I mean, and it was true to the idea that David Crane and Martha Kaufman had from the beginning, that they had had success with a couple of sitcoms at CBS and NBC, but they wanted to make something that was directly inspired by their own lives when they first moved to New York as writers. And they were, you know, they were trying to figure out what life is all about. They were bumping into the furniture, trying to find love, trying to figure out what they wanted to do with their lives. And they realized, you know, very quickly that they had left their family behind, but they had made a new family with the friends that they were meeting. And they thought, wouldn't that be a great idea for a show? And it just so happened that Warren Littlefield, who was the former network president at NBC, he wanted a show about, you know, these surrogate family friends, basically. So they developed a show and there was nothing like this at the time, Sean, where every sitcom you had from, you know, and Seinfeld, there was four characters, but, you know, Mad About You had the main two. These were the two big sitcoms at the time. With Friends, Crane and Kaufman, they wanted to make something where there are no main characters. Yeah. It's just the six
main characters. Yeah. That's what you have. And here from the pilot episode then is the moment when Rachel, played by Jennifer Aniston, makes her entrance to Central Perk in the pilot episode in a wet wedding dress. And here's what she says.
So you want to tell us now, or are we waiting for four wet bridesmaids?
Oh, God. Well, it started about a half hour before the wedding. I was in this room where we were keeping all the presents, and I was looking at this gravy boat, this really gorgeous Limoges gravy boat, when all of a sudden, sweet and low, I realized that I was more turned on by this gravy boat than by Barry. And I got really freaked out, and that's when it hit me how much Barry looks like Mr. Potato Head. You know, I mean, I always knew he looked familiar, but anyway, I just had to get out of there, and I started wondering, why am I doing this, and who am I doing this for? So anyway, I just didn't know where to go, and I know that you and I have kind of drifted apart, but you're the only person I knew who lived here in the city.
Who wasn't invited to the wedding?
Oh, I was kind of hoping that wouldn't be an issue.
Classic Friends, and that's from the pilot episode. Jennifer Aniston, obviously, there, and Courtney Cox as Monica. And of course, there's all those links. Monica and Rachel were old school friends. Yeah. Ross is Monica's brother, and there's all of those dynamics, and the fact that he always fancied Rachel all along. And then you have it is this thing, you know, in Chandler, you have the kind of the smart guy, Joey, the dumb but good looking, I guess.
Yeah.
And Phoebe, the define her if you can character, really.
Yeah.
But they could all lead a series of their own, which is something that is said in this reunion. And I think it's fair enough. It's true.
I think it is very true. Yeah. And it's interesting that they all are so different, because you wouldn't really put this group of people together. But I think it was one thing to have characters who could stand out and lead a show of their own. Mm. It was another thing entirely to have actors who would actually fit into these characters. And the audition process for Friends, Kaufman and Crane talk about it in the reunion. They met with hundreds, sometimes thousands of actors. And it was so difficult to find the right people that they actually started at one stage to write characters based on the actors that they were seeing. I mean, they talk about this in the reunion. Ross was written specifically for David Schwimmer, this burgeoning TV actor who had actually started to grow tired of, you know, showing up and doing pilots, and then they wouldn't get commissioned for an entire season. He just turned his back on TV and went into theater. But they had seen him on stage and they thought, look at that hangdog expression. Listen to that distinctive New York voice. What if we made a character around this guy? So it was very important that you had to find six people who had who basically weren't household names and allow them to gel. They were all put into a room. They were told to hang out. And they really did get on so well. And I think, and I know that's always said about every sitcom, cast, but I think it was so important that they got on so well that, you know, the show wouldn't have worked, basically.
Yeah, well, when you think about the fact, the whole issue around payment and that stance that they made, you pay one of us a lot of money, then you pay all of us a lot of money. There's going to equality across the board, which was super to hear that at the time.
Very true, yeah. They were each paid $22,500 for every episode they filmed in season one. And in season two, Jennifer Aniston and David Schwimmer all of a sudden received a pay rise. And they went to the other four people and said, we got a pay rise. Did you guys? No, they didn't. It was because the producers up top thought, you know, Ross and Rachel are the key characters. The six of them sat down with NBC and said, you either pay us all the same or we walk. Super. And that is unprecedented. Yeah. And it stayed like that the whole way through, that nobody was ever going to earn more than. And you look, that's the key to, you know, bands staying together. It's certainly the key to, you know, sitcom casts staying together.
Let's have a clip from tonight's reunion. Jennifer Aniston here. As Jennifer Aniston, not as Rachel, it's very important. They're not in character, they're just themselves. And she's talking about being cast as Rachel while working on another show.
Well, first of all, I had a graveyard of failed pilots. I'd done a pilot a year, and I thought that's what you do. You do a pilot a year, and you have some cash, and then you go on to another pilot. And I just remember sitting with these five other people and thinking, this is the greatest group of people, the greatest script. I have to do this. And I actually, with tail between my legs, hat in hand, went to the producer of the show I was on, because they hired me in second position, and I said, please release me from this show. I love this show that I'm doing right now. Nothing against your show. I just love these people, and I am having so much fun. And he said, I saw that show. I'm going to tell you something. That show's not going to make you a star. Ah! This show is going to make you a star.
Yeah, that'll be producers for you, I guess. That's Jennifer Aniston in the reunion, the Friends reunion that Chris Wasser is speaking to us about this evening. Just on the show itself, back in the day, did it get into, you know, was it just nice, cozy friends in these apartments next door to each other, and how they're going to grow apart and have to go their own ways when they, you know, find their own families, et cetera, et cetera? Or was there any cutting edge to it? Was it just pure comedy?
No, it was fantastic comedy, but there was a bit of edge to it. I mean, with the Rachel character, you had this, you essentially had a spoiled brat who'd never worked a day in her life. And we followed her over the 10 years from the time she gets her first job as a waitress in Central Perk to working in the fashion industry. She's working in Bloomingdale's. And then by the time the series ends, she's working for Ralph Lauren. We have Ross, who is this just, he's just devastated at the beginning of the series. his wife has left him, they're divorced, and we follow his character, and he goes through some very bad phases where he's not a good guy at all. He gets an awful hard time online, yeah. Sean, for being a very problematic character. But it's a, you know, to use a word I'm not quite fond of, it's a journey with him, you know. It's interesting to see what he becomes, yeah. And it's also interesting that everyone at one stage loses their job. Everyone at one stage is at risk of losing their home. Like, it does get into you know this idea that they're literally making up their lives as they go along, just like us.
Do you need to be a fan of Friends to watch the reunion tonight?
Yeah. Yes.
And will you have a laugh and a cry, I would guess, a few tears in the eyes?
I had both this morning, Sean. It is wonderful, and I really wasn't expecting it to be so. I think one of the things that makes it work so well was the decision to have table reads of iconic scenes. And there is one scene, now I won't spoil anything, where David Schwimmer and Jennifer Aniston, while everyone gives us a sense of setting, they reenact the moment when Ross and Rachel first kiss, and it's just beautiful because they don't just sit there and read off the page. They really act with their bodies and it's just wonderful to watch to a degree where you kind of get the feeling that how am I allowed to watch this? This is almost like being led into a backstage rehearsal. And when they move into the apartments and when they start playing games or remembering things from episodes, reminding, you feel as though you're eavesdropping in on a private dinner party where everyone just genuinely loves each other. And I think the biggest takeaway, there is a Q&A session with James Corden, which is not, it kind of seems a bit unnecessary, and there's a lot of celebrity guest stars in there too, but they're all really just there to say, oh, Friends did, you know, I loved Friends because of this and that, but you know, we don't really need to be told why other people love Friends. One of the things that really works for us best is that they are all so, they're right. Just delighted to be there, and it would not have worked if all six members didn't want to do it.
Yeah, first time in 17 years that they're all been in the same room. Chris Wasser speaking to us about Friends the Reunion. It airs on Sky One tonight at 8 p.m. and is available now, or is available to stream rather, on Now TV. And Friends itself is on in a million and one places at a million and one times all the time. He sold 12 million copies of his 1999 album Play and penned two controversial memoirs. Now electronic music artist and animal rights activist Moby is releasing Reprise, a new album that reimagines some of his best known songs with orchestral treatments and guest vocalists including Chris Christopherson and Mark Lanigan. That's out tomorrow, along with a brutally honest biographical documentary about his life, simply entitled Moby Doc. However, he's still having to answer questions about a certain Hollywood star who he claimed to have dated. Alan Carr spoke to The New Yorker last week, and he's with me now. Alan, Moby, very open in the past about his former addictions to drink, drugs, and to his own mental health issues. Are these central? Is that really what we're going to get in Moby Doc, this documentary that's coming out tomorrow?
Well, interviewing Moby is very like a therapy session for Moby, actually. And his new film traces his unhappy childhood in Harlem, where he grew up with his widowed mother, to the crazy success of his years as a kind of electronic star in the late 90s, early noughties. And he's always been very honest about his struggles with addiction, and in his memoirs, Porcelain and Then It Fell Apart, there's some very toe-curling accounts of his drink and drug binges. In fact, he recounts the night he tried to kill himself, and he says he's still surprised he's alive. So that is very much what we're talking about in Moby Doc.
Reprise, then, is also out tomorrow. The album is 14th since the album Play took over the world some time back. He never really recaptured the success of Play again, did he? He sold 12 million copies of his 1999 album Play and penned two controversial memoirs. Now electronic music artist and animal rights activist Moby is releasing Reprise, a new album that reimagines some of his best known songs with orchestral treatments and guest vocalists including Chris Christopherson and Mark Lanigan. That's out tomorrow, along with a brutally honest biographical documentary about his life, simply entitled Moby Doc. However, he's still having to answer questions about a certain Hollywood star who he claimed to have dated. Alan Carr spoke to The New Yorker last week, and he's with me now. Alan, Moby, very open in the past about his former addictions to drink, drugs, and to his own mental health issues. Are these central? Is that really what we're going to get in Moby Doc, this documentary that's coming out tomorrow?
Well, interviewing Moby is very like a therapy session for Moby, actually. And his new film traces his unhappy childhood in Harlem, where he grew up with his widowed mother, to the crazy success of his years as a kind of electronic star in the late 90s, early noughties. And he's always been very honest about his struggles with addiction. And in his memoirs, Porcelain and Then It Fell Apart, there's some very toe-curling accounts of his drink and drug binges. In fact, he recounts the night he tried to kill himself, and he says he's still surprised he's alive. So that is very much what we're talking about in Moby Doc.
Reprise, then, is also out tomorrow. The album is 14th since the album Play took over the world some time back. He never really recaptured the success of Play again, did he?
No, he's never zapped the zeitgeist in the same way again, Sean. Play, which memorably sampled old folk and blues songs and placed them in electronic context, was a flop when it came out first, but it went on to sell 12 million copies. At one point, it was selling 200,000 copies a week. So I started the interview and I asked him, you know, does he feel resentment about having never recaptured that success?
I like to put it in a sort of contextual perspective. When I was 17, I was playing in a hardcore punk band called the Vatican Commandos. And the first time we played a show outside of our little area was at a pizza parlor in Columbus, Ohio. I think we sold 5 tickets. The ticket sales were definitely not in the double digits. And the truth is, we didn't like it, but we were okay with that. And then when I first started DJing, I was DJing in a dive bar on Monday nights, getting paid $25 for 6 hours of DJing. I would sometimes be playing to less than 10 people in the bar. And keep in mind, there was a methadone clinic next door. So sometimes my audience at the dive bar were just people nodding out on methadone. So my standards for commercial success and audience approval were so low that, you know, like when I put out my first single, this minimal techno track Go, that before it got the Twin Peaks remix, it sold almost 1,000 copies. And I thought that was a huge success. Like the albums after Play, like 18 and Hotel, the fact that they sold millions of records to me is, if I had ever had one album that sold 100,000 records, I would have thought that was a phenomenal success. I mean, Play was such an anomaly. And if I think of it as that, like this fascinating anomaly, I certainly can't have any resentment around it.
Yeah, good answer that from Moby to you, Alan, regarding the successes or non-successes of after Play. But I guess when something has been as successful as Play, then, as he says, how do you match that? What about this documentary then, Moby Doc? Tell me a little bit more about it, available to stream from tomorrow, Alan.
Well, as anyone who's read Moby's memoirs will know, he is unflinchingly and painfully honest. He's also very funny, and Moby Doc takes a rather deconstructed approach to telling his story. There's one point where he uses toy cars to recount how his father died in a drink driving accident when Moby was just 2 years old. Elsewhere, Moby uses puppets, talking dogs, and surreal comedy sketches to tell his story. So when I interviewed him, Sean, I suggested to him that this was a distancing device and a way for him to deal with some very painful subjects.
Nothing pains me more than being a sort of disagreeable interview subject. Actually, you know, lots of things pain me more, but I don't want to be a disagreeable interview subject. But the idea was actually to not bore ourselves, because I've been a documentary judge for Tribeca Film Festival and for the International Documentary Association. So I have seen, as I assume you have as well, I've seen so many music documentaries, and some of them are lovely, but they usually do the exact same thing. A little bit of archival footage and a lot of people talking about why you should pay attention to this subject. Mm-hmm. And when we started work on the movie, we thought very simply, how do we not do that? Like, what can we do that is not just a parade of talking heads talking about me? And so we thought, okay, if we jettison the talking heads, except for David Lynch, he's the only interview subject in the movie, we were like, how do we tell the story? And that's when we started thinking, well, maybe a therapy session, maybe a conversation with a dog. Puppets are always interesting.
Very interesting man indeed. That's Moby there. And his two autobiographies, Alan Carr, were very successful. And he really gives us all detailed of his addictions, particularly in the second one, Then It Fell Apart. What's his attitude now when he looks back? Do we get a different sense of that in the documentary?
Yes, he's pretty zen about those days now. I mean, he quit drinking drugs in 2008 and he lives a fairly monastic lifestyle in the Californian countryside now, hiking in the mountains and caring for animals. But at the height of his fame, Sean, he really did embrace the rock and roll lifestyle. And I asked him, was there part of him that reveled in the seediness of it all?
Absolutely. I mean, it's almost like it makes me think of Inuit, where, you know, like we in the West, we have one real word for snow. We can call it a blizzard when it's falling heavily, but there's snow. That's it. Whereas apparently Inuit have 20 different words to describe snow. I feel like we could apply that nomenclature structure to addicts. You know, there are the fancy addicts, you know, the ones who like only drank expensive wine, you know, at Chateau in the south of France. And then they're the, you know, the sort of, we'll call them like the maudlin addicts who only drink whiskey in a pub, you know, talking about, you know, childhood, etc. I was a scumbag addict. Like I just wanted to drink the worst alcohol in the crappiest dive bar I could possibly find. Like I was happy. There's this one bar near my house in New York called Mars Bar. And it was the worst dive bar in all of New York City, which is saying something because New York City is a big place with a lot of dive bars. There's nothing scummier than Mars Bar. Hands down, it was my favorite place to get drunk.
Moby again, Alan Carr interviewing him. Alan, there's one story that seems to follow him around like a bad smell. This is the claim he has made of a relationship with Natalie Portman in the early noughties. Now, she has denied this quite vehemently, hasn't she?
She has indeed, Sean. And before I interviewed Moby, I was asked, was I going to ask him about Natalie? And that naturally got my hackles up because no one likes to be told what to ask. But I was told in a follow-up email that it was fine if I asked. Moby just wants to be prepared for the question. And it's a question he's been dealing with now for over a year since the story broke. And he was in danger of being cancelled by the toxic trench that is Twitter over this. So in the second book, Then It Fell Apart, he recounts how he had a brief relationship with Portman when she was 20 and he was 33. She's firmly denied this and actually suggested he was being creepy. So he spent the past year apologising to this and trying to explain it all. And he really does tie himself into knots of psychobabble about it all. So I just went ahead, Sean, and asked him, does he cringe when he thinks about the whole situation?
I mean, again, there are, and I'm not trying, I promise you, I'm not just trying to be mealy-mouthed and diplomatic and dodge the question, but there are, as is often the case with interpersonal things, there's a lot of, there are nuanced layers, as I said. And if you and I were to meet up as, you know, as friends and have a three-hour-long conversation, if you were interested, I think that I could explain things in a way that you would have, suffice it to say, a different understanding. But I mean, I learned because I've been attacked publicly so many times now at this point. You know, I remember one of the first times I remember this happening, and it was minor but also extreme. It was 2002, 2003. And I read a comment on one of those websites like Gawker and Gothamist. And this person wrote that they hated me so much that they were going to stab me to death and watch me bleed in front of them. And this little voice in my head said, you know, handing my emotional well-being and handing my sense of self over to the opinions of strangers is probably not healthy. So now I have this one sort of categorical rule, which is, I don't read reviews. I don't read articles about myself. I don't read comments. If I'm on TV, I don't watch myself in TV. So I have almost no awareness of how I'm perceived by the public or what sort of public life I have because I don't pay attention to it. And then every now and then some story sort of breaks through. Like recently there was I posted something about the etiology of zoonotic pandemics, and I was criticized. And I guess it took on a life of its own. And I just was like, well, I could explain myself. But as we've all learned, you cannot explain yourself to the mob of the internet.
Moby there speaking to Alan Carr. Alan, I must say that he's a very engaging interviewee and doesn't no holds are barred.
Absolutely. Quite refreshing in that respect. As I say, I think he deals with interviews as therapy. He's still in therapy himself, but he gets to, you know, he says that he feels freer during interviews and he's kind of able to unburden himself because he never reads back what he says. And I'd thoroughly recommend the new documentary because he really does explore these issues very honestly and in a very kind of interesting, irreverent way as well. He brings a lot of humour to what is, there has been a lot of pain in his life, but he manages to bring humour to story as well.
And Chris, that title is super, isn't it? Moby Doc.
Oh, yes.
he knew what he was at with this one. All right, Alan, listen, thanks for that and thanks for sharing the interview with us. Alan Carr's interview there with Moby. Moby Doc, available to stream from tomorrow, and the new album Reprise will also be available from tomorrow on the usual platforms, I would